Good evening, everyone. First of all, I give you a warm welcome to Mr. Eskil Erlandsson, Vice Chair of the Committee on EU Affairs of the Swedish Parliament, and the 10 members of the same committee, along with staff members, and certainly not least, Her Excellency Cecilia Björner, Ambassador of Sweden to Malta, and her colleagues. I would like to let you know that this meeting is being webcast on the internet. I don't know if there are any objections to that. I've never found a politician who objects to be on camera. So I will now introduce my colleagues. On my left, the Honourable Frederick Atsopardi from the opposition side and from the island of Gozo, Honourable Joe Samuth from the government side, and Honourable Michael Falzon from the government side. Unfortunately, Honourable Tony Fenech, spokesman for the opposition, is abroad on Commonwealth business, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs has other scheduled commitments. I would like to draw some comparisons between our two setups so that one will put things into perspective. The Swedish Parliament, the Riksdag, pardon my pronunciation, has 349 members, whereas our Parliament is made up of 71 members. And apart from the executive, the other MPs are sort of part-timers. We're all part-timers here. Your EU Affairs Committee is made up of 17 members, who in turn are members of other parliamentary committees. And your government must gain parliamentary support for its EU policies ahead of meetings in the Council of Ministers, and when it is time for a decision and before meetings of the EU Head of State and Government in the European Council, the government consults the Committee on European Union Affairs. Our committee is made up of 9 members, together with our 6 MEPs, who are ex officio members, and has the dual function of dealing with the EU and foreign affairs. Although government is not bound to seek parliamentary approval prior to decisions taken at Council of Ministers or European Council meetings, the committee does scrutinize the government's position on EU policies and legislation, and may invite ministers to brief the committee before or after council meetings. Besides, we have the practice that the Prime Minister invariably makes statements in Parliament, followed by questions and answers, after European Council meetings. And in the case of ministers' councils, the same applies when important decisions are concerned toward the ministers. We also are included in the security and defense policies at parliamentary level, because we don't have a defense committee in our parliament. So we take even the role to represent Maltese parliament in the CFSP and CSDP, the Interparliamentary Committee on Security and Foreign and Defense Policy. By way of introduction, I will stop here and then invite you, Mr. Erlandsson, to make your introductory remarks, and then we will engage in an exchange of views on issues of common interest and concerns, not least on the Maltese EU presidency and the future of the EU, both in the context of the 60th anniversary of the Rome Treaty and the white paper issued recently by the Commission, Commission President Juncker. Mr. Erlandsson, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for taking your time talking with us. Since you have the presidency now, we think it's very convenient that we talk with each other, because we have some interests in special things like the Brexit, like migration issues, but also how we handle the European affairs in the future, since we have debates in many countries today whether they should be and become a member or not in the Union. My name is, as you said, Eskil Erlandsson, and I represent the Centre Party in the Swedish Parliament. I am a member of Parliament since many years ago, and besides that, I've been Minister for Agriculture and Fishery during 8 years in the government in Sweden. Beside me, I have some colleagues, and I suppose that you want to introduce yourselves.
Marie Granlund is my name. I'm from the Social Democratic Party, and I'm in the committee, of course, and also in the committee on finance.
My name is Lars Axel Nordell. I am from the Christian Democratic Party in Sweden, and I am in this committee, EU committee, and in the committee of environment and agriculture.
Thank you. Good evening. My name is Cecilia Magnusson, and I'm representing the Moderat Party, the Conservative Party, in the Parliament, and except the European Committee, I'm also in the Committee of Culture.
Good evening. My name is Jens Holm, representing the Swedish Left Party. I'm also a member of the Committee of European Affairs and also the Committee on Environment and Agriculture.
Okay, good evening. Good evening. My name is Gunilla Nordgren, and I'm a member of the EU Committee and a member of the Environment and Agriculture Committee.
Yes, good evening. My name is Börje Westlund, and I'm also from the Social Democrats Party. I am a member of the EU, the Committee on EU Affairs, and also in the Committee on Finance.
And my name is Matthias Tegnér. I'm a member of the Social Democratic Party. I'm a member of the Committee on EU Affairs and also working in the Committee on Social Insurance, which in the Swedish Parliament also handles migration. That is me. Thank you so much for receiving us.
One thing that interests us, that's how Brexit will affect you and what you think about the coming financial problems that will come up since Great Britain is a net contributor to Brussels and the systems and the funds and so on that we have within the European Union. How will you handle the things from your side and what do you think about the Brexit overall, since I suppose you have cultural relations to United Kingdom and historical bands and connections to Great Britain. That's one thing. And then we have the migration issues that are really big and great all over Europe. How do you see upon those things? How can we reach an agreement that are sufficient for all of us also bring in those that are a little bit negative to solve the problems within the Union today, because as I see it, that might be a question that can split up the Union, and that isn't what I want, and I don't think you want it either. How can we solve these two very, very big problems? And what's your view upon a solution?
Well, if I had a solution for migration, I would sell it for the highest bidder. Well, jokes apart, let's start with Brexit. And I'm speaking, obviously, at parliamentary level, because here we're speaking on behalf of a committee that obviously takes matters at parliamentary level. In May, we're going to have the COSAC plenary. One of the topics is going to be the state of play of Brexit. And we don't know yet if Article 50 is going to be triggered or not. But we are presuming that yes, it would be. So what we're going to do is to open a discussion to see what's going on at the time. As on a bilateral level, Malta and the United Kingdom have excellent relations. They have had excellent relations ever since. But even though we have these great bilateral relations, we are going to take the side of the European Union as regards negotiations with the United Kingdom on the package that they are going to negotiate on their exit from the European Union. And on a bilateral level, yes, we have agreements that are going to still be kept into force on various subjects, like education, like health, for instance. But on everything else, that we're going to take the stand of the European Union. I think the Prime Minister was quite clear on that as well on many, many occasions. But I don't think that we should haste this divorce. I don't think it's beneficial to any, not even to the European Union and not even to the United Kingdom, to just force it like now we have to have to decide, we have to find a solution as fast as possible. Because I think that both sides really have not yet calculated all the aftermath effects of this decision. But especially the citizens themselves, British citizens and European citizens. And they will have to take decisions, I think, very cautiously, without hurting anyone, but at the same time, if a member of the European Union decides to opt out of the European Union, there cannot be any special status. You're either in or out. That's obviously even at the governmental level, but that's something that goes beyond the remit of Parliament. Well, regarding migration, I think we had a very good, let's say, first step towards trying to achieve a long-term solution to the problem of migration, especially migration flows that come from the Mediterranean Sea. And for many years, this country, together with Italy, even at parliamentary level, had voiced our concern that there is a huge problem in the Mediterranean with people crossing from North Africa to our shores, to Italian shores. Each year we had thousands of people dying in tragedies. And I'm afraid to say that for many years, even at parliamentary level, I had this experience when I represented the Maltese parliament in COSAC and even in the SEF, SPCSDP, that no one bothered. The European Union thought it was a problem that we had to face, Italy had to face, that the Mediterranean states had to face. And we continuously were warning Europe, this is not a problem of the Mediterranean, this is a problem of the whole European continent, the whole European Union. And now it seems that these worlds have realized themselves, because eventually the whole of Europe has realized that there is a huge problem of migration flows from Syria, from the Balkans, and even from the Mediterranean Sea. From the Mediterranean Sea, we had even concerns about security of the European Union, because we had intel that extremists could infiltrate through the migrant flow, and we didn't have the resources to actually prevent that. So that's why we wanted the European Union to actually intervene at all levels, even on security level. After the Valletta meeting last month, during the informal summit, I think that all member states, and including even Eastern European states, which I believe they are the most reluctant to find a solution as regards migration flows and burden sharing, have reached a final decision, yes, to start to tackle the problem at source in the Libyan territory. All right, it's one thing to say it and it's another thing to implement it. But to have all member states agreeing on that principle, I think it was a very, very, very good start. The logistics and the political part of it and everything else, it's going to be a nightmare to implement. It's not going to happen in months, but it will take years to actually start functioning properly. And the most important thing, I think, is that we shouldn't accept the fact that if you throw money at a problem, you solve that problem. But we have to actually see that the money that we're investing in this solution actually goes to that solution. So I believe that it has to be monitored by the European Union closely. Whatever plan it's prepared to actually combat the flow of migration from North Africa. Because you can have a policy stating that you can open your borders and to welcome all refugees, but that will mean that you're actually encouraging more and more refugees to just cross the Mediterranean Sea, encouraging the abuse coming from these criminals who actually indulge themselves in the smuggling of people. So, closing the borders, well, you cannot close borders when you don't have any, because when you're an island or you have a coastline that's facing the Mediterranean Sea and there are people who are drowning, you are duty-bound to save them and to welcome them in your own country. So yes, I think that the best solution is to tackle it at source. It was a good start, but it has to see each and every member state contribute actively towards the solution to be an actual effect made to make it work. Actually, it's not easy. It's not going to be easy. So, for maybe this problem for people who come from the north, it's not a problem that you can actually feel it. For migrants crossing every year. I mean, we found ourselves in situations years back. Under Merkel Fatson was the Labour Party spokesperson for internal affairs during the days and months when migration flows were at their peak. We had migration flows compared to our size and the population density. It's like having a million people entering at once Germany, for instance. So that was the size of the proportion of the problem for a small island like us. Obviously now Italy is taking the bulk of all the migrants. It doesn't mean that because they don't hit the news anymore that there are no more crossings. In fact, there are thousands of crossings, even during the first months of this year. Fortunately enough, maybe we are trying to save as much people as possible, as many people as possible. But it doesn't mean that the problem is not there. We have a problem facing in Libya that there is a government, but the Libyan people, they don't recognize it as their government. Not all of the Libyan people recognize it as their own government. So we have a very fluid state in Libya that can change overnight. And that's going to be the main hurdle for the European Union to implement what has been decided here in Malta last month. I don't know if the problem of migration has ever been discussed within your committee, and if there were any suggestions to the Swedish government from the Swedish parliament on how one can tackle migration. So I pass the poll to your court.
Upon that question, we have debates.
Well, I felt like Bjorn Borg actually. Gets
every week, I say, we have debates and discussions how to solve the problems around migration, but also what to do and how to handle the situation as it is. As you know, we took, I think it was 163,000 last year, and that's, yeah, that's something.
How was it taken in Sweden, that political decision? Was it welcomed? Was it something that, yes, people think, well, that it's a duty for them?
The present government had to close the borders in mid-November, I think it was, yes. 2015, because that the situation was critical in many ways, schools, hospitals, house and living. We have a climate.
That's because everywhere we see that Scandinavians are the happiest people in the world. So that's
but and Swedes overall, I'll say, think that also refugees should have as a level, not a low level, but a medium-sized level for things, and that was really critical in November, early winter time last year. It was.
So you had but you have a migration flow inside.
We still have, but now it's, I'd say, 2,000-3,000 a month or something. And that we had had for many, many, many years from Hungary in the mid-50s to the Baltic states in the 60s, Finns a lot, from Southern Europe in the 60s. So we are used to it, but in 2015 there came too many in too short time, and we couldn't handle the situation. And that is
as they came from the migration flows coming from the Balkans up to Germany and crossing
from Germany, Denmark, but also from Russia, through Finland and Norway. Mm-hmm.
Refugees,
yeah. I think it was in August 2015, Putin opened up the borders I think it was from Turkey.
Through
Russia,
Caucasus.
Yeah. If we had a solution, we would come up with it. We don't. That's.
But I don't think you can actually stop migration.
No.
Intrinsic in the human
nature. 100 years ago, one fourth of the population of Sweden went to U.S. and Denmark and Germany and so on to get jobs. So we had had it, but the other way. Once upon a time, in those days, Sweden was a real poor country. But then we found the steel and or the iron in the ground, and we had the forest and so on, and the economy. And we didn't take part in the two world wars, so we had an industry that were unaffected, and we were lucky and have our welfare. So it has been the other way for 100 years now, but 100 years ago we had immigrants from our country, a lot of immigrants. So that's a real tricky thing to solve. But if we come back to Brexit, as it is now, you are a net contributor from the systems to your funds, but without UK, I suppose you will become a net payer, because now you have reached the average in the EU. How does that affect you and the people and the willingness to pay to Brussels?
There was a report, I don't remember who submitted the report, who made the report, who said that Malta is the country that has most to lose from Brexit. Actually, I don't remember the author of the report, which company made that report. But it's true that with Brexit, if it's not handled carefully, yes, Malta can suffer mostly from this move of Britain going out. So yes, we have to tread very carefully. That's why I said we have to be very, very cautious, so that neither party gets hurt. So it's not something. Unfortunately, at parliamentary level, I speak from our side. We're not really in a position to actually decide anything, because it's something that's being decided at the Council of Ministers and summit level. Parliament can only scrutinize what the government's position on certain issues regarding the European Union, and as I said, the government is not bound by what Parliament says. So there's no really essay that can actually influence the decision that they can take place at council level and ministerial level. So unfortunately, as I can only speak from a parliamentary remit. I cannot, obviously, say what's going to happen, because I cannot speak on behalf of the government. I don't know if there are any other of your colleagues who would like to.
Thank you so much. Well, I think when we talk about these issues, I think it's important at least to try to have two thoughts in mind during at the same time. I mean, in the short run, it's obvious that the situation is a struggle and a burden when a lot of migrants end up in Europe at the same time. But on the other hand, I think with a proper integration, migration can of course be beneficial to a country. I remember myself the situation in 1992. In respect of the war in former Yugoslavia, where there were big discussions in Sweden when, I think, in 1992, around 90,000 immigrants arrived to Sweden. And at least parts of the Swedish society were arguing that this would be a problem and the cultural differences were too big. But looking in hindsight, I think we can see that this has been very beneficial. These persons are highly integrated in the Swedish society and are contributing very, very well. With this as a framework, my questions are in regard to these external and internal questions. I know that everybody is speaking very highly of the Maltese presidency, and there are a number of issues to handle. And my question is, as I said, in regard to the external and internal part. When I'm talking about the external part, I'm thinking about the agreement with countries outside Europe. And internal, I'm thinking, for example, about quotas and Dublin and EASA and so on. And it would be interesting to hear your view on these topics and the possibilities of moving forward with a number of the internal acts being discussed within the EU framework right now, since there are some, can you say, lock-ups in some of these areas, or at least slight disagreements.
I can refer to the plan, the Commission plan for the relocation of migrants. Malta was one of the first that agreed to that plan. And unfortunately, there are countries who are opposing it and even attacking it in front of the European Court of Justice. And until now, we are still debating, even at a Cossack level, that this program, the implementation program, has not yet been implemented. And when this question arose during the chairperson's meeting here in Malta last January, I made my point very clear that each and every delegate, instead of complaining with the presidency or whoever there is chairing, if this plan has not yet been implemented, everybody should turn towards his own government and ask his government to implement what has been agreed upon and what was a legal binding decision. Unfortunately, that didn't happen throughout many countries, not just those which are actually opposing, in effect opposing such a relocation plan. Well, Malta, having been carrying a burden for many years on its own, cannot but agree to such relocation plans, because we've been calling for burden sharing for years and years and years. And now, finally, there is understanding about the magnitude of the problem, and that's something that has to be divided between the whole member states on the basis of one of the main pillars of what constitutes the European Union, solidarity. And it is always our opinion that solidarity needs no adjective. So it's either solidarity or not. When we had to save our money and to bail out countries that are members of the European Union, that was solidarity as well. And we weren't even blinking about thinking of doing it or not. But when regards to saving human lives and sharing this burden, we are still here debating. So. May I introduce Honorable Francis Amit Demek, who was also a foreign affairs minister during the last session.
My apologies for joining late for this meeting, but I was unfortunately held up with another commitment. If I can add a couple of comments on this issue also as now opposition spokesperson on migration. I think when you talk of relocation, one cannot but not register our disappointment, and it certainly cuts across party lines in Malta. And the fact that when we were speaking of relocation of 160,000 migrants from Greece and from Italy, even that was already deemed as very symbolic, because it was a far cry from the total number that should, even out of proportionality and subsidy and solidarity rules and co-responsibility rules, should obviously have been a far higher number. But when we now speak so far of about 11,000 that have been relocated, including Malta's small share, fine, but Malta did its part. So that is certainly disappointing. And the time limit for that full relocation is now pretty soon. And I, quite frankly, I don't think anyone realistically expects it to be achieved. And that is placing, let's say, in some doubt, the level of credibility of how the European Union can deal with that issue. I believe you refer to Dublin. Well, the present Dublin rules are obviously very unfair on countries, especially on countries that save people, let's see, because the burden is placed on the country saving, as opposed to more international maritime rules, which would at least place the emphasis on the closest safe port of call. And therefore, Dublin regulations need to be revised. This is, again, the stand being taken across party lines in Malta. And we hope that the signal in favor of a revision of the Dublin rules is now at least activated. And I will keep it at that because in the light of what I said earlier, I will refrain from any undue optimism even about moving with regard to a revision of Dublin rules.
I don't know if there are any other members from the Maltese House of Representatives who would like to make an intervention.
Honourable Michael Fatson, who is also the spokesperson for internal affairs.
I'll switch to Brexit for a moment. My colleagues here have basically, as even with Francis Amidemek has just pointed out, there has been relatively cross-party agreement on migration issues. And as already pointed out, although we honestly feel that we had been left alone for a number of years, we took our share from the 160,000, something which others did not. But passing on to Brexit, I think the issue with Brexit is rather fluid. I mean, even if one follows reports, you read a couple of reports today and tomorrow, and they'll say that it is expected that, well, just give an example, production will go down or whatever. And then the following week, as unexpected, or rather, as not expected, it's gone the reverse. With us, in our position as presidency for these coming 6 months, maybe we are in a position to have had the British as temporary guests for 200 years. Because it all started on a supposedly temporary visit to get Napoleon out, but the temporary visit lasted for 200 years. And we have there quite a lot of their legal system, definitely their banking system, their administrative system, if you like. And in administrative law and constitutional law, follow the Westminster model, so maybe we can help there because we can understand each other. Obviously, 200 years of guests, or whatever you like, have had their influence as well. I mean, if you look at our tourism, you'll find that the biggest contributor is the British market. So yes, I think we will have to handle that carefully as a country. But I think, as even the chairman has pointed out, things are still very fluid. So I think that entrenching positions, both on a local scale and on a European scale, should not be the position of any of the two parties. There's a lot still going on, and there's a lot to be expected to go on even well. The issue is more complicated with developments we have seen in the States. I mean, banking and finance in Brexit will definitely be something which will not affect just the British and the European Union, but will affect a lot of things. There was the fallout of the merger between the German Stock Exchange and the London Stock Exchange and what really made that. And there's a lot going on. And I think that the upcoming elections will also be some. We have Germany coming up and Italy pretty soon, or likely to be pretty soon, and all the others. So I think we should not hasten to take positions with the issue of Brexit. This discussion has been going on for decades. I remember it. I'm a lawyer by profession, well, like the four of us here, four lawyers. And I remember this discussion being academic when I was a first-year law student 30 years ago, whether somebody could go out of the European Union. Well, we're facing that. Let's hope we just don't face any more, especially on the 60th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome. Thank you.
One other thing that I would like you to point out, and we didn't mention, was that during the days when migration flow was really great and enormous here for us in Malta, and the biggest contributor for taking migrants and refugees from Malta was the United States of America.
the United States took more refugees than all the other European member states put together from Malta. So, I don't know if there are any other, or from your colleagues who would like to.
Yes, thank you for receiving us. It's a very interesting discussion. I would just like to ask you, is there any main differences between the majority and the opposition about EU matters, I speak in general, or are there consensus about the way of handling the EU questions?
Well, had this question been put like what, 14 years ago, there would have been great differences. But now, no, I don't see any differences regarding European Union's affairs, not even foreign affairs. In fact, I think this area is one of those very few areas, which include maybe even sport, that the opposition and the government are in unison. We both try to seek the best interests of our country.
We had so many divergences in the past, I think that we don't want that again.
Well, it's enough.
For
the opposition, I was going to state, we moved from total divergence to total convergence. and as the opposition party, we're obviously proud of the fact that the convergence was my Labour Party moving to our side.
And the irony of life is that the Labour Party now is in the presidency, the helm of the presidency of the European Union.
That's how it goes, no?
Yeah. It's life.
Okay, it's a very interesting discussion. I would ask you about, it's a complicated situation, but we have Turkey, and we have not been talking about Turkey. And now, yes, now there are living very many people there, and they are negotiating with EU, and if EU doesn't do what Turkey wants them to do, they can open the border. And that is the political situation in Turkey as well. But now I think about EU, Turkey, and then negotiation. And if they say, well, then we open the border, what happens then? Are you discussing that? Thank you.
Next question.
Are you aware we beat the Turks in the Great Siege in 1565?
No, that's a very,
no,
very,
I'm
very
joking.
Hot potato. One cannot ignore the fact that Turkey is one of the strongest economies in the world, and not even Europe. And after what happened, I think it was last year, the failed coup, and what's worse is what came after that. The relations, how they deteriorated, I think, between the European Union and Turkey itself. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the European Union should be kept at bay by subtle threats like opening the borders. Because I think it's in the interest of both countries that a mutual solution is found. What I can underline a positive aspect coming from Turkey, that there were discussions regarding the withdrawal of the Turks from Cyprus, and that would have been a major step forward for Turkey to actually become a fully fledged member of the European Union. But what happened after the failed coup and the way people were handled and treated, I think it goes far, far beyond the beliefs that actually make us European, the fundamental human rights of the individuals. And that's, I think that the bridges were metaphorically destroyed by those actions, and I think the European Union now is a bit cautious on its relations with Turkey. But I think it would be a crucial mistake if we antagonize Turkey for what's happening internally. And regarding the migration flow, I think that it is impossible to ignore Turkey, and obviously whatever decision has to be taken, we have to sit down with Turkey. Disregarding maybe for that particular moment in time and focusing only on the issue of migration, disregarding what's happening internally in Turkey itself. So I think that, like, we shouldn't ignore Russia, we shouldn't even ignore Turkey, especially regarding migration. And I don't think there has been any discussion at parliamentary level regarding the relationships between the European Union and Turkey, not even in our conferences. But I think this topic
would arise in the next meeting in this Common Foreign Security and Defense Policy that's going to take place in April. Because obviously migration is going to be a central topic in this conference with Federica Mogherini, who will be present, and she is going to have a whole session discussing the implementation of the migration policies, and I think this is a subject that will crop up definitely, especially since the Turks are also observers for these interparliamentary committees with other countries, obviously with non-EU countries, and there has always been an exchange of views regarding this matter. But I think it would be a crucial mistake if we start antagonizing each other. So it's complicated. It's a very subtle balance that we have to move really cautiously on how we may even put words across the table.
On the other hand, there's just to continue on the Turkish issue, because the situation in Turkey is extremely worrisome. And what lawyers, what opposition parties, what human rights defenders, what the minorities, the 20 million Kurdish people is expecting is that the rest of the world must stand up against Tayyip Erdogan, because Erdogan is, for every day, is turning more and more into a true dictator. And if the European Union and our member states, if we don't, in this case, raise our voices, who should do that? But with the EU, and now I speak more personal and from my party's perspective, but with the EU-Turkish agreement, our future destiny is in the hand of Erdogan, because we can't really criticize Erdogan, because, as you mentioned, Gunilla, Erdogan can easily just let the steam and let hundreds of thousands of migrants cross the border once again. So I see these agreements as something extremely complicated. Just quickly to come back to the relocation issue, there has been a decision taken, as mentioned, that 160,000 should be relocated. Malta, Sweden and Germany, I think we the three countries were the first of raising the issue of a permanent relocation mechanism in the European Union. Now you have the presidency, and if you don't manage to run this issue in goal, no one else will do it. So I just wonder, since we have a common interest here, there must be anything else we can do in order to increase the pressure in this issue.
I don't think it was a coincidence that the decision was taken during our presidency to start actually tackling the issue at source. You mentioned Erdogan and the way that things are deteriorating in Turkey with all that regard of fundamental human rights. I agree. But that reminds me of another dictator who was living south of Malta. And when we cried that there was a breach of fundamental human rights, I was referring to Gaddafi, after his demise, all hell broke loose. It was like opening Pandora's box. So even now that there is no dictator, there are still the fundamental human rights being breached, not reported. Even fundamental human rights that are breached among migrants themselves. We continuously get reports of how people in Libya who are waiting to cross illegally are being treated. So, did we exchange one traitor to 100, 1,000? One dictator for 100 or 1,000? Because fundamental human rights are still being breached. Even though I agree with you that yes, as Europeans and what we believe, the fundamental human rights, I think that we should not disregard, however, the strategic position that maybe even ourselves, as the European Union, has put Erdogan right now. So,
some comments again from my end. I mean, with regard to the question of the relocation, well, of course, the process started earlier. But clearly, it would be, even if I, when I examine the priorities as outlined in various documents of the government of Malta with regards, and documents specific to the Malta presidency, it is on the list, as it were. What I expressed earlier is my doubt whether it is achievable. But that does not mean that there isn't lobbying going on, and the matter certainly seems, from what at least I can follow, even from the opposition benches, but that the matter appears to be raised even in various bilateral meetings that I have, where Malta obviously would be acting even in its role as the role of presidency of the Council. But the fact that we are so far away, I mean 11,000 from 160,000, to my mind, in realistic terms, not in desirability terms, makes it not particularly achievable, which is very, very unfortunate. With regard to the Turkish situation, there are, of course, all the strategic considerations, which I think the chairman outlined very well. But clearly, the situation with regard to human rights, with regard to freedom of expression, in particular in Turkey, cannot be ignored by the European Union, especially in the context of membership discussions. Because how can one tally that situation with taking on board the acquis unitaire of the European Union and adhering to the principles, especially under freedom, under justice, various chapters. So that is the situation. Now, does that lead to shutting the door completely, or does that one leave it ajar because of the strategic considerations and the migration agreement? I would think because of geopolitical considerations and because of other options that Turkey may pursue, one leaves the door ajar. But, on a personal note here, I think to think of pursuing membership in any realistic sense with that situation prevailing and not being corrected would be a negation of our identity as Europeans. So, and we need to convey that message in one way or another, even if we are diplomatic enough not to lose sight of the strategic considerations.
May I, Mr. Chairman, once again express our thanks for spending an hour with us and talking around difficult issues and giving us your opinion upon those questions that we have discussed here. And may I also wish you good luck during the coming month now during your presidency. We really need it for Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for giving us the honor to meet you and to be able to exchange our views. I don't know, are you leaving today or tomorrow? Tomorrow. Are you having further meetings or? Okay, so no time for enjoying the sightseeing.
Enjoy the sun.
Well, tomorrow. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you.
Annak hozzá, hogy elbét menet a parlament, Erzlandis a parlament, orvegy iszabésnyi, hogy összefe lefenáret alkosszak, ez a szörf Malta, fölfáj támbrú, a címmel a precedentén, a szöplen, a leladóan a